to understand disagreement and to understand a different side of an argument, my intuition as I started writing this book was these are the kinds of things, if you take away the technical language, these are the kinds of things that everyday people can also use as they work to understand those people or those arguments that they just don't understand or they just don't think are plausible or within the bounds of reason. And so I'm trying to equip people to do that better.
Welcome to the Guilt, Grace, Gratitude podcast, a show devoted to bridging the gap to the historic Reformed Christian faith. Listen in as two friends, a layman Nick and a pastor Peter, discuss the newest and best books in the broader Christian tradition with some of the most respected seminary and college professors, pastors, theologians, authors, and more. We hope these book club episodes introduce solid theological works to those who want to read but don't know where to start or who to trust. You'll be introduced to authors you know and many others you don't from various theological traditions, but all under the broader tent of our shared creedal tradition. All of these authors and books help us to do the same thing. They remind us of how the finished work of Jesus Christ changes everything.
This episode is brought to you by the Davenant Institute's educational arm, Davenant Hall. Interested in dipping your toes at Davenant Hall this upcoming Trinity term from April 8th to June 15th? Registration closes March 29th. Here's a taste at the courses. 1st and 2nd Corinthians with Joshua Shaw, The Mercy of God in Scripture and Tradition with Ryan Hurd, Male and Female in Modernity with Alistair Roberts, Introduction to Syriac and Arabic Theology with Charles Carman, Philosophy as a Way of Life with Joe Minich, Aristotle Seminar 1, Ethics and Metaphysics with Tim Jacobs, Early Christian Worship, Ritual and Space in the Ancient Church with Matthew Hoskin, Reformation of the Modern World with Michael Lynch, Christian Epic and Old English Literature with Anthony Cirilla, Moral Theology for Counseling with Jim Pachta, Anglican Polity with Nathaniel Keane, and Philosophy of Law with Colin Redemer. GGG listeners who are first-time Davenant Hall students get a $25 discount on auditing any of their Trinity term courses from April 8th to June 15th. Registration closes March 29th with code GGGTrinity24, which is in our show notes. Go to www.davenanthall.com to sign up. Hey, this is Peter Bell, and I am in the beautiful wine country of Central Coast, California, in Santa Maria, north end of Santa Maria, in Santa Barbara County. I serve Redeemer OPC, Redeemer Orthodox Presbyterian Church, on the north end of Santa Maria. We meet at Temple Bethel, which is right there, Temple Bethel, at 11 a.m. for Sunday service and 9:45 a.m., so just before that, for Sunday school. For all ages, we have Kids Sunday School, Adult Sunday School, or all Sunday school at 9:45. You can find us at discoverredeemer.org with one R. Again, discoverredeemer.org. We have a bunch of activities throughout the week, but most importantly, Sunday, we have the gospel preach, the sacraments administered, and church discipline faithfully brought out. So I hope to see you here at Redeemer OPC in Santa Maria, Central Coast, wine country of Santa Barbara. Hope to see you.
Hey everybody, this is Pastor Danny Hyde from the Oceanside United Reformed Church. I want to invite you out to our church. We meet in sunny Southern California, here in San Diego, and we meet at the Army Navy Academy in Carlsbad, right along the ocean, as you can see, the Pacific. And we meet every Sunday at 10 o'clock in the morning. We hear the Word of God, we hear the Gospel preach, we have the Lord's Supper every Sunday morning, and then we have Sunday school at about noon for kids. We come again together at 5 o'clock every night, Sunday night, for teaching, prayer, and singing. And then we also have various midweek groups, Bible studies, men's, women's, and also other Bible studies as well throughout the week. So I want to invite you out to worship with us. If you know anybody in the area here in North County of San Diego, invite them as well. Let them know. You can find out more about us on our website, oceansideurc.org, or also on all those various social media to find us as well. God bless.
Hey, this is Peter, one of the co-hosts. We're doing something new. All ads will be fronted before the episode for unimpeded listening pleasure. A quick plug for our show, Guilt, Grace, Gratitude. Would you consider giving to our show? We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so your donations are now tax deductible. We've got two options to give. One, email us at guiltgracepod@gmail.com if you'd like to send a check or use our direct donor link. Or two, go to our show notes and click on our donor box link to give a recurring donation or a one-time gift. You can also click on our Patreon account in the show notes and sign up for monthly exclusives, merchandise, coupon codes with publishers we work with, giveaways for our subscribers, and much more. All donations we're gifted are used exclusively to pursue our mission to bridge the gap to reform Christian theology. Would you join us? Now, on to the show. Hello, welcome to the Guilt, Grace, Gratitude podcast, where we bridge the gap to reform Christian theology for your listening pleasure. As my esteemed co-host, Nick Fulweiler, who was not available at the time of this recording, likes to say, it's another day of fresh grace and mercy. We are on our book club episodes on Thursdays, and we have our good friends at Zondervan, who's published this book, Learning to Disagree, The Surprising Path to Navigating Differences with Empathy and Respect, with Dr. John Inazu, whom we have on the show to talk about this book. And you can find a link to this book in our show notes. Go to our show notes, pick up a copy for yourself and for those that you know as well, maybe for church study, for friends, for family, for pastors, whoever it may be. And even if you disagree with them, that's the perfect person to give this book, Learning to Disagree With, to. You will also find in our show notes the NAPARC Church Finder. When you go to that Church Finder website, you type in your zip code, and it'll auto-populate all the nearest Reformed churches to you in your area. Also, go to guiltgracepod.com to find all things Guilt, Grace, Gratitude podcast, as well as our newly uploaded store, our merchandise, which has a shirt, mugs, and a few other things as well as the confessionalpods.com, the confessional podcast network that Nick and I founded about 2 years ago with like-minded podcasts, and as well as our sponsors, Davenant Hall being our main sponsor. And also those who donate to our show, we are a 501c3 nonprofit. So any donations that you give to us will be tax deductible. And you can email us for more information on that. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. Let's get on to the show.
We got John Inazu, who's the Sally D. Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University in St. Louis. Teaches criminal law, law and religion, and various First Amendment courses. He writes and speaks frequently to general audiences about pluralism, assembly, free speech, religious freedom, and other issues. He's written three books and published opinion pieces in the Washington Post, Atlantic, Chicago Tribune, LA Times, USA Today, Newsweek, and CNN. He's also the founder of the Carver Project Legal Vocation Fellowship and is a senior fellow with Interfaith America, and he finds time to breathe in his office every once in a while. But it's a pleasure having you on the show, Dr. Inazu.
Peter, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you.
Of course. And you know, I always ask this beforehand, and I didn't ask this before doing this. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Oh yeah, you got it. It's Inazu, but you should call me John. That's fine.
Okay, cool. So we got the formal out of the way. Now we'll go informal the rest of the way. So we got your bio, but if somebody is just now learning about you and like, okay, this John guy, John Inazu, let's get to know him beyond the stuff that he's written for outlets or his books or his law professorships. Let's get to know John Inazu outside of his bio.
Yeah, cool. So start with my family. My wife, Caroline, and I have three kids. They're 16, 14, and 11. And so right now we're doing a lot of stuff, you know, with them. My 16-year-old is now threatening college. She's getting close, so I can feel that pretty acutely. And I don't know, like there's not a ton of spare time, but in the spare time we have, I like to get together with friends and feel really grateful to have good friends here in St. Louis and around the country. Lived in a lot of different places, so have developed different friends and networks around the country over time. And I just got back from Kenya with my son, so that's another
Huh.
a big recent trip we've had together.
Yeah, what was in Kenya?
We were visiting actually a friend of mine I've known since eighth grade. He's over there with his family for the year. So we went and saw them, and then I spoke at a university in Nairobi and did a little safari. And so for like a father-son trip, my son's 11, it was awesome.
That's super cool. Yeah. So, first kind of real question on this is it's already in your bio, but you've written pretty extensively on the First Amendment, on religious liberty and plurality, as well as Uncommon Ground with Tim Keller. This is a few years back, I think 01 or 2021. Where did the idea for this book come about?
The new one?
Yeah, the Learning to Disagree. Yep.
Yeah. So, kind of started gelling in my head at the height of the pandemic when we were all isolated and angry and confused. And I was just thinking about, if we're going to get back to some better set of relationships, we're going to have to work on this better and differently. And it occurred to me that a lot of my own experiences in the classroom, but also just living life as a lawyer, had something to say about how ordinary people might better disagree around the dinner table or in the neighborhood or the workplace. So that's kind of what started it. And then as I started putting it together, I thought, this is going to work much better if I can provide a story with a narrative arc instead of a bunch of teaching points, or just a chapter of instruction sheets. So
Sure.
that's what kind of gave life to the frame of the book.
Huh. So that's brings me to the next question, which is cool because you saw the questions beforehand, so you're probably seeing this too. So the structure of the book is pretty clever. It starts from August, and I think it goes either till May or June. So it covers a full 2 semesters worth or full academic year. You begin the book with your preparations to teach in August, and you end with your classes in June, so finals and all that fun stuff that people know about. Why follow the calendar for teaching? So you're a law professor at Washington University, St. Louis. Why follow a teaching schedule in a book about disagreeing? It seems odd at first to do this around a calendar.
Yeah, so a couple of things there. One is I wanted to explore how my experience, especially in the classroom and teaching law and helping people understand what law can show us about disagreement, how that unfolds in an actual classroom setting. And so I had to set that up based on the calendar rhythms and to so I could take a reader through the experience of a classroom. But I'll say another thing that kind of hit me as
Yeah.
I was writing it is that I could then model and demonstrate how conversations over time can actually unfold in an environment of built trust. So when you have plot lines and stories and people who are actually in relationship over time, you can do a lot more with that. And you can show readers why, at one point in time, it's a lot easier to have a hard conversation than it is when you're first meeting or first starting a class. So that was kind of part of the reason for the temporal sequence.
Okay, cool. And maybe behind this too, because we interview a lot of theologians, and very few law professors who write at the intersection of law and faith. What got you into First Amendment issues? What got you into the law practice, first and foremost? I think you studied engineering in college, if I read that correctly. So
Yeah.
what got you into the law profession in general?
Yeah, it was a very twisted road. I mean, as in windy, not, malformed. I was an engineering major in college. I discovered very early on that I did not like engineering, but I was there on an ROTC scholarship, and basically
Okay.
the deal was they would pay for college, but I had to major in engineering. And I actually loved my friends in campus ministry and local church. And so I was really committed to staying there, but it meant that I had to do this major. So I kind of basically just rolled up the sleeves and did 4 years of civil engineering, desperately looking for how to leave it. And then I thought, well, I'm going to go to law school as an escape hatch from engineering. I didn't know anything about the law, had never talked to a lawyer. I just knew it wasn't engineering. And that was really the sole motivation of going to law school. And then from there, sort of took a very long and somewhat non-traditional route to get into law teaching. I practiced law for 5 years. I was a youth pastor for a couple of years. I did a PhD and eventually ended up teaching law, which is great.
Yeah. So, further into this, you make you make a case, and this is somewhat overarching throughout the book, that interpreting and applying the law, I think for a lot, and you talk about this, everyone kind of assumes it's like, okay, this is what the law says, and this is obviously what you got to do, and so they just go do it. This is what the law says, and this is what everybody has to do. Why is there any disagreeing about this stuff? It isn't unlike learning how to disagree, because you say it's a lot more complex than just this is what the law says and I'll just apply it. So how does interpreting and applying the law, how does that apply to learning how to disagree?
Yeah, I mean, so when you think about what lawyers do, or at least what good lawyers do, it depends on knowing the other side of an argument really well.
Yeah.
So you can be a kind of, you know, echo chamber advocate and a loudmouth, but you're not probably going to be a very good lawyer at the end of the day. Being a good lawyer means really wrestling with the other side of an argument and understanding it, its best form, its complexity, and then also understanding why, when we get into legal and policy disputes in this country, we have systems and laws as a way to resolve those. And it's a pretty great alternative to street violence, right? That we have this in place. So it's a good thing that we have the law, but learning the tools within the law to understand disagreement and to understand a different side of an argument. My intuition as I started writing this book was these are the kinds of things, if you take away the technical language, these are the kinds of things that everyday people can also use as they work to understand those people or those arguments that they just don't understand, or they just don't think are plausible or within the bounds of reason. And so I'm trying to equip people to do that better.
Yeah. And this is a side tangent, but I think it's also relevant. When students come to law school, and again, you write about this in the book too, how do they usually approach the law? And then this again has something to do with learning to disagree. How do they approach the law? And then how are you hoping to kind of redirect them? So, you know, it's not quite that cut and dry. So even for your own students, how do you hope they come through law school, not with a different understanding, but how to better approach the law and how to make decisions based off of various case studies and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, you know, law, like any specialized discipline or area of knowledge, is hard, and you have to learn the inner workings of it and the mechanics of it. And one of the things you discover when you study law is it's not nearly as black and white as you thought, right? The doctrines and the cases are much murkier and harder. And the reason we get hard cases to the Supreme Court is not because, one side of idiots came up with something and another kind of side of really smart people came up. It's because we disagree over what the meaning of words are and how these come together and what our laws should be. And it's really hard. And that's one of the things that law teaches you. And I'll say, though, as a Christian who's writing about and teaching law, I also want the law to be something. I want it to mean something, right? This is not there are people who throw up their hands and think it's all about relativism.
It's power, not like any interpretation goes, or like kind of think whatever you want about it. Like there is something there. You just have to interpret it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really important to hold on to the there that's there, or else you'll just kind of throw up your hands in despair, right? Or think it's a big power game. And I don't think that's true about what the law is actually doing.
Yeah, and this would be a bridge question to my next one, and I think it's going to help set it up. A lot of Christians fear higher education, and I'm assuming too, legal, business, whatever, anything that's like above undergraduate, even undergraduate, a lot of Christians fear kind of the environment around some of those universities, kind of be at Christian universities. What's been your experience as a Christian teaching at an elite law school with, I'm assuming, a bunch of people who don't agree with pretty foundational stuff that you hold to firmly like we do?
Yeah, I mean, so I'd say it's a mixed bag, but it's mostly fine. So I talk about, I mean, as you know from the book, I talk about some pretty hard encounters with protests and student activism and different things where I've had challenging moments here for sure. And it can be hard. And I teach at a university that is not religious and doesn't always support what people of faith want to do. And at the same time, most of my days are kind of normal, right? Most days are not about like a huge activist culture. There are students wanting to learn and teachers wanting to teach, and it's just fine and it's pretty normal. And that's kind of important to probably how most of us live our lives, that our lives are not really narrated by a bunch of headlines and exclamation points, but it's doing the ordinary work that we're called to do. And then I'll also say, and this is not generalizable everywhere, but in my sure. experience here, you know, this is a place, Washington University, where I was able to found a ministry around Christian faculty, and we're very public in what we do, and we're not trying to take over the university, but we do have a place here.
Yeah.
We want to, you know, serve faithfully and mentor students and partner with area churches. And we've been able to do that for the last 6 years. And I think a very healthy and vibrant way.
Yeah. So that's good into this upcoming question. So there was, as everyone who's now listening to this has heard, some of the stuff that happened last December with Harvard, Columbia, Penn, and trying to figure out how do we navigate some of these issues. And like I said, universities, elite universities at that, all universities at that, have become a battleground of ideas. Better yet, a place where ideas are shut down, not really dialogued with, like you talk about in this book, and you profile some of these things as well. And they're seemingly shot down more violently than ever before. At least that's what we see, I guess, in media. And you interact with students on a daily basis, those who begin and then those who end at law school. And this is something you talk about again in the book. What's behind some of this? Why are ideas from what you see in law school shot down or feared? And then how are you hoping that students interact with you and students interact with each other better than just saying, I can't get behind that, or that's against me, or I fear this stuff? So yeah, if you could talk about the ideas in the university complex and in the law school that you teach, and how that can inform Christians in general.
Yeah, I mean, so I think there are a couple points here. One is the institutions themselves need to have good leadership and clear purpose. And when you have both of those in place, this kind of thing happens far less frequently. And when it does blow up, it doesn't sort of take over the local narrative, or doesn't kind of cripple the institution. But so it matters to have good leaders who know what the purpose is and also know the boundaries of reasonable disagreement. And I think we've seen good examples of that. And we've also seen plenty of bad examples. And I think students will follow the signals that come from leadership in many cases. Now, on the student side, you know, these things don't always go well on the group me or in social media. So I try to encourage my students, get offline, get face to face, be with the people around you. And you asked at the end of your question about Christians too. Same thing applies, right? I mean, how many times have we been on social media where we just feel compelled to write something? And when does that really ever matter? Rarely, right? Usually the best answer is to let it go, or to move a conversation offline and face to face. And so I think the more that happens, the better these kinds of environments unfold.
Yeah. Amen. I'm not good at that myself, but I think that's something we all have to work on. Maybe too, pushing into this more. So there's a woman you talk about who wants to do directed study with you on Augustine. And this is, I'm trying to think more, okay, this is not just the outside of that's happening to us. This is something that we deal with. This is something you dealt with. And thinking, oh, this woman's like, she's going to have the wrong thesis, and I'm going to disagree with her. And at the very end of the book, spoiler for those who are listening, she comes out with a really good thesis, and like you say, a really good paper. What is it like your experience dealing with disagreement, and also somebody at the church that you had gone to or still go to? How have you yourself dealt with difficult topics or assumptions about other people coming into disagreements or conversations, like, oh my gosh, this person again, I don't know how I'm going to deal with this again. So how have you dealt with this yourself?
Yeah. I mean, and part of the reason to include some of those stories is to illustrate that I'm sort of learning alongside the reader.
Yeah.
Here,
you're right? Not the guy who's got all the answers that people learn from. You've dealt with this.
Yeah. And I'm continuing to deal with it. I mean, and this is a very sort of human challenge that doesn't really fully ever go away. So I think part of this, you know, the example of the student that I'm mentoring in terms of her thesis, and starting with the presumption that this person's never really going to get it together or learn or be teachable, and then being surprised by the end where she really does come around. And sometimes the coming around is not on our own timing. You know, in some cases with students, it's years later that they reach out and say, you know what, on reflection, what you said or what happened is making more sense to me. And so part of the, I think the lesson to me is that people don't always change or respond on my time frame or on my expectations, but
unfortunately.
Well, so the question was sort of about like what I learned myself and
yeah, this. What you're learning yourself and how you're dealing with yourself. Yep.
Yeah. I mean, so I've included in the book some stories about my own growth and relationships with people and the kinds of lessons I learned from engaging with them. So there's a story about a student where it takes some time, but the student comes around and really surprises me and how she can learn through a mm-hmm. set of experiences where I come to the conclusion earlier than that maybe she's unteachable and that proves to be incorrect. And there are other examples of students in my life where it might be a period of years down the road where they write me and say, actually, on further reflection, I've learned about something new and I realized what you were doing now in a way I didn't know. And so that we're all works in progress and we don't always sort of make that progress on what you and I would like to see in terms of responsiveness and time frames and that sort of thing. And then there's another story in the book that I talk about with a church friend, and mm-hmm. I include that really as a matter, almost like a method of self-reflection to say that there are points in my life where I sometimes separate the world falsely into those teaching and learning environments where people make mistakes and the rest of the world where we're supposed to have it together. And in reality, we're all making mistakes all the time, right? And other ways to have more grace and more patience and more understanding with each other, even outside of the training wheels, classrooms, but in the rest of life as well.
Yeah. So that brings to my next question. Like you already said, you're not only a lawyer and a law professor, you're a Christian, and which warms the cockles of my heart, you're a Presbyterian. All on top of that stuff. This is good stuff. And these disagreements have not buffered the walls of the church, like you talk about in the book. They've entered into the church. And it's not just out there in culture having conversations, it's in the church we're having these difficult conversations too. You got plenty, like you talk about stories of these. And so I want to ask kind of a two-part question, both positively and negatively. How have Christians not learn to disagree, and what does that look like? And then on the positive side, how can we learn to have these conversations better and not just say, oh, that's just culture's issue, let's just leave it to them, or they're wrong and we're right? So how have we learned incorrectly, and how can we learn better to have these conversations?
Yeah, so on the how we've learned poorly, I think is more a recognition that we are being formed oftentimes far more outside of the church than inside of it. I mean, you might, whatever people are doing on a Sunday morning or a Wednesday evening is far surpassed by dozens of hours on social media or differing news sources. And so this is ultimately a matter of formation and liturgy and practice. And when most of your life is from the malformed sources, then it's going to look bad, and it shouldn't be a surprise when it does look bad. And I think a lot of sort of churches and religious institutions have dropped the ball on the formation question, because it's going to take a pretty strong response to beat that malformation. In terms of what the opportunities are, though, we could do, I mean, it's still the case that the social institution of church is one of the few unique places where people can come together consistently over time and around the same people and build trust and build opportunities to dialogue with each other. So if we can do that effectively, if we can get people talking and trusting, and then do that in the frame of, we do have some pretty remarkable theological resources and the fruits of the Spirit and other promises that we have as Christians, that can really help us in our engagement with one another.
So I'm going to ask this question from a slightly different perspective. If somebody, and I'm thinking, again, because we have a majority Christian audience who listens to us, a Christian who comes and says, I get what you're saying, Dr. Nazu, but like I there's nothing I can agree with kind of culture out there. How do I learn how to disagree if there's nothing to agree with on their side? But how would you kind of go about a conversation with somebody who thinks that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the first question would be maybe a challenge, the premise to say we have a long history within the tradition of Christianity of engaging actively with culture and learning from and borrowing all aspects of culture, whether it's from art, politics, knowledge and philosophy, and you know, don't miss out on the riches that are out there from other parts of culture. And that can be extremely helpful to the building, cultivating, and sustaining of Christian faith and the Christian tradition. But I think it's also, you know, almost as a discipline, it's useful to ask what you might find good about the things you don't like, whether it's a political party or a person or a piece of art or a relationship. And I mean, if you can really take time and invest in whatever that other person or thing is, and if you really conclude there's nothing there for me to learn, then it might be time to go back to the drawing board about how you're engaged in the first place. I mean, just ask, what about this object or person or party reflects God's goodness in the world?
Because you're a First Amendment scholar, that's what you've done most of your work on, religious free speech, plurality, religious liberty, fostering environments of disagreeable yet civil discussions. And what is so vital about this, about these issues? And maybe to provide a negative foil, how have the First Amendment and religious liberty been misunderstood in both secular and sacred quarters? Why is it so vital to foster that environment for disagreeable and civil discussions? And how has that been misunderstood by both kind of culture and church in general?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, one point here is I sometimes say civil liberties are for losers. And what I mean by that is you only need them if you lose out in the political process. If you're the majority, or if you have control of government, you either write the laws you want or you build in exemptions for yourself. It's when you're in the political minority or when you lose that you then really respond or need to rely on civil liberties and rights protections. And so that's, you know, the other point related to that is we're all going to be on the losing side at some point. This is politics is too dynamic and too unpredictable. And so think of this almost like a mutual non-aggression pact. I need these liberties. You need these liberties. People we don't like need these liberties. And you need them most when you've lost. And so to protect them on the front end, we need to have a common commitment to them. And that means protecting and allowing for positions and viewpoints that we don't like. And I think for Christians in particular, it's extremely important to see especially religious freedom as a right that is guaranteed to all and that needs to be protected on behalf of all. So as we advocate in the public square, yes, we should protect our own ability to worship and be engaged in the country, and so should other faiths. And we should equally lobby in the defense of other faiths to do the same. Even at the end of the day, if we're allowing people whose views are different than ours to thrive and their viewpoints, that's how a democracy and how a pluralistic society works.
Yeah, and maybe I'm gonna channel my inner critic on this, even though I agree with you. I'm gonna channel the inner critic who says, I get it, but if they're wrong and God's word says they're wrong, then why should we allow them a seat at the table to talk about this stuff? Because if we're allowing these disagreements to take place, how is this not unloving of me to say, no, this is wrong. I can't allow them a place at the table, which feeds into our fear of agreement with them or us not having good conversations. So maybe if you could talk to somebody who says, I see what you're saying, but I'm fearful of where this leads down the road, where this is kind of me implicitly saying that your views are just as truthful as my views are.
Yeah, I mean, so none of this, you know, requires or depends upon capitulating to some form of relativism or anything like that. You can hold convictions with confidence and engage with other people across difference. When it comes especially, though, to legally enforced norms, the difference between persuasion and coercion matters a whole lot, right? So I might still want to be able to persuade someone else of the wrongness of their view or the correctness of my view, and that's really important as well. But if we're going to turn to coercively, one of the things I would advocate for in these situations is let's err on the side of persuasion, not coercion.
So lastly, what is your hope for how this book might contribute to us having better conversations where we're rather certain, and maybe the Lord works in a different way, where like, yeah, we're not going to agree on this. How can we better learn to disagree? Because this, like you said, this book is not a propositional, okay, here's the steps to agree better or how to have better conversations. How do you hope this book comes alongside of us and says, you know, it's okay to disagree and this is how to do it?
Yeah, well, so really what I'm hoping for here is that this will encourage a move toward practicing and habituating to a different form of engagement. So this is not, you know, you said correctly, this is not a how-to manual or anything like that, right? But it is meant to provide a set of conversations that might help people toward different postures in their engagement. And the only way to do this is practice over time. As I say in the book, don't start with your family because they can sometimes be the hardest,
yeah.
You know, but start with a friends or get a group of people who are different than you and read through this book. There's a reflection guide at the end, or read through some other book and just practice the art of disagreement and practice working on building up the other side's argument in a charitable and recognizable to them fashion. And create the spaces of trust where you can take risks and have these conversations. That's a good starting point.
Yeah. And lastly, you're writing this, and my assumption is just like me, who I preach each Sunday, and after Sunday, I'm like, I know this and I don't practice this. So for you yourself, as you're writing this, how did it either convict you or help your journey along learning how to disagree better? When I'm assuming you're writing it at night or writing in the morning, and then you just had a conversation that day. I was like, I'm writing on this. How am I not learning this stuff?
Yeah, totally. I mean, in fact, in some of the stories that appear in the book happened in the midst of my writing the book, right? And
yeah.
So I'm doing this almost real-time reflection of, oh, at the end of the day, I botched it, right? Like, I'm writing about this very thing, and that was really hard. And so I think the lesson for me is we're all works in progress, and we're never done with the learning of this. So the learning, and the word learning in the title is really an ongoing, never-ending learning, and that's who we are as human beings.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Anazu, thank you so much. And for those listening, I know we had technical glitches on this. We'll smooth this out as much as possible in post-production. I really do encourage, I saw a couple reviews of this book online. I 100% agree with them. This is written beautifully. So I want to just give you a little bit of encouragement on that. And it's also hilarious at points. It's written well, and it's like, there's just funny stories in the midst of it, which makes it a joy to read. So people can go to our show notes and find this. I'd encourage churches to buy this, pastors to buy this, congress to buy this for somebody you disagree with and say, hey, let's learn how to do this together. I think this would be a really good start of the conversation. Thanks for coming on the show and for talking about how you have dealt with this and how you're using your experience and your work to help others better deal with the same thing, because it ain't getting any better. So we're gonna figure out how to do this together.
Thanks, Peter. Great to be with you.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed this week's book club episode where we spotlight a specific book from a publisher and an author that both Nick and I really enjoy. We don't always agree with everything that the author or the book comes about, but what they do share with us is love for Christ and his gospel from whatever tradition they come from, whatever creedal tradition they come from or confessional tradition. We all do share the same broader ecumenical Christian faith from different backgrounds, ethnicities, and denominations. We hope that these introduce books that you might not have heard of before, authors that you might not have heard of before. I've been really helped by learning about some of these. If you want to go to our show notes, find a link to the publisher, that helps them out a ton. A link to the author's page, to the book, to purchase it from the publisher themselves. It really helps them expose their work through the publisher themselves.
Yeah, and the value that we're bringing with these book clubs is you guys can really rely on us, because as we all know, it takes a lot of time and effort to stay on top of all the books that are coming out and know which ones are probably good to look into, be recommended to read, look out for. And so these episodes are to whet your palate. We've already know that we're going to recommend this book, but you can listen to the episode yourself, get a little more understanding of the book and the author, and then go from there.
Yeah. So if you want to find these books and purchase one for yourself, purchase one for friends or family, and also too, if you can find us on Apple, Spotify, any podcast catcher, rate and review us. That's how we're best known. It's how we kind of make ourselves known. Introduce these to a friend and maybe just build your bookcase, build your reading, read broader and read really well, all under the umbrella of our creedal faith under Jesus Christ.